Welcome to the REI Mastermind Network, where host Jack Haas gathers amazing stories from leaders in real estate investing. In each episode, our guests will tell you what they're doing that works, what they've tried that failed, and best of all, you'll learn actionable steps to take your real estate investing to the next level. Now, here's Jack with another value-packed episode.
We have Jim Lee here with me today, and you can find a lot of information regarding Jim, and he does give something away for free. So head over to jlmrealestateinc.com/free-product, and I'll make sure to have that link as a clickable link in the show notes. So head over to that, but really appreciate your time here, Jason.
Yeah, no worries. Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate you having me on your show.
So Jim, so everybody knows, is a real estate broker, and he's got a lot of multifamily real estate investing experience in helping high income earners find those proper and running the numbers and finding those proper investments. So we're going to pick his brain a little bit today regarding this. But I first have to, you're a fairly young guy. I'd like to have a good idea as to how you found this path and how did you get into real estate?
Yeah. So, I got into real estate when I was 20 years old. I was kind of in college at San Diego State searching for what I wanted to do and kind of fell into it through networking and joining all different kinds of groups on campus. And I met my old mentor named Brian, and he kind of hired me on to his commercial real estate firm down here in San Diego, a small multifamily firm with about 20 agents. But him and his partner were amazing mentors. They taught me the business really fast. And got my license beginning of my senior year of college, so my last year of college, and did four or five deals before graduating. So I kind of had that nest egg to fall back on since, you know, brokerage is an all commission, no salary job. And then from there, you know, after COVID and 2021, my business exploded. In the last 3 years, we've done about $200 million in sales for about 120 transactions. So kind of had that big growth when a lot of people were kind of complacent and seeing what was going to happen during COVID. And then I was kind of in the office every day, just grinding and trying to make things happen, and paid off. So that's how I got into real estate.
Yeah. You know, it seems like, and it could be just because of my backyard too, that a lot of the realtors that get into multifamily and becoming a broker at your level, there's usually a progress or progression there. They start off with the single family homes and they kind of move their way into the commercial properties. Is that how you did it, or did you jump right into commercial?
Yeah. So I haven't actually, I've probably sold one single family house in my entire career for a friend. And I jumped right into commercial. So commercial for residential properties considered five units on one lot or above. So yeah, I jumped kind of right into the fourplexes up into, you know, 20 units kind of my first year, and then kind of stuck that route. So yeah, there was no progression for me starting in residential and moving up to multifamily.
And as you've been progressing here, do you do any investing yourself, or is it mostly the brokerage?
I do. Yeah. I started investing, beginning of 2021, and, I have all in San Diego. We have about 14 properties down here in San Diego.
Okay. San Diego is kind of a tough market. How have you found it?
Yeah. I mean, I think all big cities are tough markets, but yeah, California is definitely tougher than most markets. But I think when you're a broker or an agent in a city and you really know every street very well, I think you have an unfair competitive advantage. So I think having that knowledge and knowing values extremely well in each submarket kind of helped me figure out what was a good deal, what was a bad deal, what was a good opportunity, what wasn't. So I think having that knowledge and learning as an agent and a broker kind of helped me kind of blossom into an investor that's kind of understands exactly what's going on.
Is there any lessons that you've learned along the way that you would have known when you started off?
It's a great question. I think the biggest lesson or lessons I learned in the real estate business is to be patient. I mean, I think a lot of people in the past have tried to grow extremely fast and have kind of overstretched on deals, maybe gotten too much leverage and kind of lost their butt. So I think the best piece of advice I learned was, you know, grow, you know, steadily, but don't grow too fast where you're going to over leverage yourself. And, you know, you might have one mistake on a deal and things could go south from there. But, that was probably the biggest advice I got. And, I think the second biggest lesson is, you know, buying properties for below market value. I think when you're buying a property that you can, you know, put a lot of money into and has a lot of upside to increase the rents, increase the values, and kind of take your own destiny and do what you need to the property to make it go up in value. That has really grown my portfolio really fast. So I think having that investment strategy, but also being very conservative has helped us grow steadily in the last 2.5 years.
You mentioned the importance of your mentors in your brokerage, in your, you know, career. Have you found a similar situation in your real estate investing? Do you have the same mentors or a different set of mentors for your real estate investing?
I'd say for my real estate investing, I think I just asked a lot of questions to my clients when I was just being an agent for them, finding them properties, and got acquainted with a lot of people that I work with. So I think just hearing advice from hundreds of investors that I've worked with has been kind of my mentorship. I don't have like one person that I fall back to and I'm looking at properties. My mentors at my old company, I left and started my own brokerage about a year and a half ago. Sorry, about a year ago. So I don't really talk to them much anymore, but I do have a partner that I own most of my properties with, and he has 10 years or more experience than me. So being a partner with him has helped a lot in kind of understanding how to handle the operations, asset management, and all the good stuff when it comes to investing.
Yeah, you're kind of in a unique position because you kind of have a front row seat as these investors are running the numbers and reviewing properties. Are there some of those lessons along the way that kind of surprised you?
That's a great question. I think from seeing everything and being on the front lines, I think what surprised me is kind of how a lot of investors have a very narrow mindset of investing. Like, for example, a lot of people will only look in like one zip code, will only buy a certain year built. A lot of people will buy only like a certain amount of bedrooms per property. So like some people will only buy a property with 2-bedroom, 1-bath units in it. If there's one bedroom, they'll pass on it. So, I think it's kind of surprised me how a lot of investors have a very strict criteria. But I think the best investors that I work with have a very open mindset to where whatever the property looks like, whatever location it is, if the numbers make sense and there's room to make money, they'll go after it. So I think the people who are more creative and kind of have more of an open-minded strategy to investing have done the best that I've worked with.
Why do you think some of those individuals have such a strict underwriting criteria?
I think they have very strict criteria because number one, a lot of them are mom and pop, small, you know, private investor. To be honest, a lot of them kind of have that mindset and criteria just from like generations of family. So like their parents might have only looked for a certain amount of properties in this location or by the beach, or they won't go anywhere else besides, you know, 2 miles from the ocean. So a lot of it has been just through like generational wealth and kind of what their family has invested in the past and what their criteria has always been. And then some people just don't want to own property too far from where they live. So a lot of people care about the location. They don't want to be like more than a 15 to 20 minute drive from their property. So location and just overall investment criteria as a family history has been a big, big rebuttal on why, when I ask, why won't you look here, or somewhere else?
You know, I've heard multiple times that when it gets to multifamily investing, that's where things can really get creative. What are some of the most creative purchasing events you've seen that was able to be negotiated?
With the actual property or like in the negotiation between a buyer and seller?
Well, both. I mean, like, you know, it seems like, you know, there's been a couple times, for example, where we've bought a multifamily property and it was like the only time where the seller was willing to do some carry backs and a few other things to make the deal happen, where you wouldn't typically find that type of thing in a single family home.
Yeah, no, that's a great topic. Yeah. So I've been a part of a few seller carryback, seller financing deals where the sellers owned the property for over 30 years and, you know, had no mortgage on the property. And when we made an offer on the property, we could put about 15% down and the seller carried back rest of the loan at about 5% interest only for 5 years. So that's a great way to get into to multifamily property if you're dealing with an old seller who's owned the property for a very long time and has no mortgage on it. So that's definitely one event. Also in multifamily or commercial in general, but there's a lot of loans that are assumable. So for example, if you bought a property and you had a $2 million loan with Chase Bank and it was a multifamily loan, so let's say it was a 10-unit apartment building and it was a $2 million loan, if you were still within the fixed loan term period, a buyer can come in and take over the loan, and it'll waive the fees that the seller will have for prepaying the loan early. Because with commercial loans, there's a prepayment penalty of anywhere from 1% to 5% of the loan amount. So I've structured those many times. And in regards to the property itself, what's really been a creative way to add value and make, you know, good money with your multifamily property in San Diego has been the ADU laws, or the accessory dwelling unit laws here in California, but especially San Diego. The city of San Diego is extremely bullish and very lenient on these laws. Like for example, we converted two garages on a duplex lot and turned it into a fourplex by making one garage into a two bedroom, one bath unit and making the back garage into a one bedroom, one bath. And that built over almost $600,000 of equity, and the capital expense into it was about $150,000. That's been a really creative way on how investors have been making money in this market in San Diego.
Sure. Can you kind of give us an example? Like in San Diego, like I mentioned, it's kind of a tough market because of the high cost of real estate. But you've mentioned a couple times now of adding value. What are some of the value adds that you've seen some of your investor friends doing in that market to make it worthwhile?
Yeah, I mean, I'll just mention my own. So I mean, for example, our main strategy is to kind of help the tenants move out that are paying a really low rent. So for example, we bought a fourplex in South San Diego, and the tenants were paying about 50% below market value. And our property managers helped them find a different unit for cheaper, a different location, because we told them that we were doing significant renovation to the units and the property. Mm-hmm. So after that took about 2 months. And then from there, we spent about $175,000 remodeling the four units in the exterior. We bought that property for $1 million in probate. And then from there, we sold the property for a little under $2 million to a VA buyer. And then we took those proceeds and did a 1031 exchange into a 16-unit building in San Diego State area, because we sold two fourplexes, which is 8 units, and we bought 16. Our investment strategy and how we've added value and grown our portfolio very quickly is buying properties cheaper that are, you know, fixed up. I mean, that need to be fixed up, that have a lot of work needed. We'll build a lot of equity, sell it, and then we'll do a 1031 exchange, which is basically a tax deferred event where you sell a property, and if you buy a like-kind property and for a greater price and you take on the same amount of debt or more, instead of paying capital gains taxes, they're deferred, and you can take all your proceeds and put into a bigger property. So that's kind of what we've done. And that's what I've done for a lot of clients as a broker. So that's worked really well for our investments.
Right. Is that how you've been scaling so quickly, is essentially adding that value and then doing the 1031 exchange and just keep growing into a bigger property each time?
Correct. Yeah. So you build a lot of equity into, let's say, a fourplex that you buy, and you have a lot of equity that you've built. You want to capture that equity and sell it for maximum value. And then you want to buy a bigger property to scale faster. And when you buy that bigger property, if you bought it as like the same criteria as the property you sold, you can do the same process again. So you're kind of repeating and rinsing over and over again.
So just to remind everybody, head over to jlmrealestateinc.com/freeproduct. And take advantage of what Jason is offering there. Jason, I wanted to revisit something you just said just a minute ago, which I think is very interesting. And I don't think it comes, frankly, it seems like one of the most obvious things to do, but a lot of people don't think of doing it, is that you help people move out. Most people are so like stuck on keeping the existing tenants that that's like a blind spot for us. In fact, that would be a blind spot for me in many ways. But what a great strategy if the market is under rented, instead of raising the rents on those existing people, telling them what's going to be transparent, telling them what's going to happen. If they want to stay there, the rents are going to go up drastically, or simply help them move. I guess it doesn't occur to a lot of people. What made you think of that? Or is that just part of your partner's experience?
Yeah. So in California, we have something that's called AB 1482, and it's a rent control law where you can only raise rents 5% plus CPI per year. So we kind of have a gridlocked amount that we can raise per year. Like, unlike Texas, we can't just go in and buy, a multifamily property that's running for $1,000 a month and just boost it up to $2,000 the next day. So that's why we kind of have to, do what we do, or else like the plan won't work. We'll be raising rents for 5 years to get it to market, which drastically affects the return or IRR. So to answer your question, the reason why we do it is because, just for return purposes, but we also do it in a way that is much more empathetic to the tenant. Like, a lot of people will just post a notice for 60 days and expect them to move out. And a lot of tenants will dig their heels in and fight when that happens. But when you actually talk one-on-one with the tenant, you visit them, you tell them what's going on, and you're very transparent, and you want to offer them help, such as moving costs, hiring a moving truck, helping them find a new place on Zillow, apartments.com, like actively helping them move, because people are lazy and people don't want to move out of their home. So if you actually are compassionate and you want to help them move out, then they'll be much more receptive to your business plan that you need to execute, which is essentially moving them and renovating it and re-renting at a much higher rent.
And I would imagine that in the end, it I don't know if it's the same amount of cost or if it's actually cheaper, but in the end, you're probably going to be spending that time, money, resources, whether they dig in their heels or you help them move. So it's the better of the two choices, I see it as.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, if a tenant digs their heels in for an extra 1 to 2 months because they're fighting you on moving out, that increases your carrying costs. So you're paying your loan, your interest, your taxes each month that tenant stays in the unit. So speed is the name of the game. And in order to have speed, you got to be a compassionate person that helps them move. And you got to have a really good contractor to renovate the unit quickly and have a good property manager that kind of oversees everything. So you got to have a good team around you.
Set those laws in San Diego regarding the rent increases, that only is applicable if there's a resident in there. Is that the case? Or do you have to do anything else to the unit to justify the increase?
No. So once the tenant is out of the unit, you can, no matter what happens, you can raise the rents to whatever you want. So you're not limited. You don't have to like do a certain amount of renovation or do a certain amount of increase. You can increase it to market, whether you do any work or not to the unit.
Okay, sure. So if somebody is getting into real estate investing for the first time, what would you suggest they do to get their feet wet?
If they're trying to get into real estate for the first time, I would say don't try to figure out the business by yourself. I would say try to find some help around you, find someone in your network that might have some sort of experience that kind of knows what they're doing, and, you know, pick their brain and ask what's going on, and then do your homework, listen to great content like your podcast. And then eventually you got to just take action and chip away every single day. I mean, the first year in real estate, as you know, is extremely tough. It's the hardest year of your life, but just like building a business, the more you put time into it, the easier it gets and the more experience you get. So I would say those first couple of years, I mean, it's an absolute grind. You got to get through it. But if you listen to the right people and you take the right action, there's no reason why you won't be successful.
You know, one of the things that I find interesting with you, Jason, is that you, not only are you a real estate agent that deals with multifamily properties and commercial properties. And I mentioned that in my market, that almost seems aspirational. People kind of progress their way there. But you also, as an investor, kind of jumped right into multifamily investing, which is also aspirational. Would you say that that's kind of a mindset thing that people need to break through, that maybe they should just consider jumping directly into multifamily investing?
Oh, for sure. I think everything's in our heads. I'm glad you said that, because I think I meet a lot of people that kind of ask about multifamily, and I can tell they have that mental block on like whether they think they don't know enough or if they're not good enough. I mean, I'm just an extremely average guy who worked my ass off and got to where I am. But I think if you can kind of remove that imposter syndrome mindset, and you can get over the fear of, you know, buying your first property or selling your first property, getting your license and going straight into commercial real estate, anyone can do it. It's just all in their heads on why it's not possible. I mean, I know a friend who she got into multifamily, and she raised a whole bunch of money and bought like 200 units in Texas for her first deal. So, you know, it's all in your head.
Mm-hmm. You know, when somebody is coming to you as a broker for the first time, and they're looking at multifamily investing, especially in the San Diego market, I'm guessing that's where you, is that where you hold your license?
Yeah, California. Uh-huh.
So where I'm getting here is the fact that more times than not, though, when I've dealt with some realtors, frankly, know very little about real estate investing themselves. So what kind of experience do you typically try to provide, especially those newer investors, when you're helping them look for a property? Do you kind of guide them and provide a little mentorship yourself?
Oh, yeah, every single time. I think that's what kind of helps me stand out, because there's a lot of agents out there in every market that sell the actual product type but don't own any of the product type they're selling. So there's a lot of multifamily or office, retail, industrial brokers out there that actually don't own the product themselves. So they can only advise on the sale. They can't advise on the actual management or the actual day-to-day activities that needs to happen for you to succeed as a real estate investor. So yeah, I mean, I advise anywhere from the debt, which is helping them find the best financing and helping them find the best deal, and then also referring them to great property managers, contractors, helping them understand what it's going to be like, what the cost might be to renovate a unit, what the expenses will look like, such as the water, trash, sewer, electric bills, on average will look like on a whatever size building they're buying. So yeah, I mean, I can help from a multitude of ways, and I think that's why my clients have appreciated working with me in the past.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, with all that being said, there's a lot of people that are listening to the show right now that are considering getting into multifamily, and they're talking to different real estate realtors. What type of questions do you think they should be asking to make sure that the realtor knows what they're doing and is a good fit? It's a partnership.
So there's a lot of first time or newer investors out there that will work with someone who sells single family homes. So a residential realtor who doesn't even specialize in the product type, but you know, that realtor will understand that there's an opportunity and try to make a commission from that buyer who's looking for, let's say, a 4-unit or an 8-unit in the area. I would highly caution working against someone who doesn't sell multifamily for a living. If they don't specialize in this asset type and they sell, you know, they do open houses, they sell single family homes. I mean, we don't even do open houses, right? Because it's all based on numbers. So it's a very different asset type. So I think the number one red flag you should look out for is if the agent you're working with doesn't sell multifamily for a living, then you should be highly aware of what could happen, because they don't know much more than you know, probably, because they don't sell the asset type. So You want to work with an expert who knows exactly what bad things will happen and what good things can happen from a transaction. I'd say number two is make sure you ask the agent or the broker if they've ever managed or owned this kind of product type themselves, to see if they can help more if you had questions about the actual management of the property. I think that's really important. And then I'd say number three is just make sure that the agent you're working with is selling a lot of the product type that you're looking for. So if you want to develop a relationship with a new agent or broker, and they're either not selling that much or they're not selling the same product type that you're looking to buy. So let's say you're looking only in this location of San Diego, but you only want to buy in North County, San Diego, or let's say LA. You got to be very niched and understand what agent is doing the best for what exactly you're looking for in terms of price, size, and location. So those are okay. My three tips for that.
Sure. Well, with all that, again, I wanted to remind everybody one last time, JL Ash free product. I'll make sure to have that link in the show notes. I wanted to call out one fact too, is Jason also has a podcast. It's called Multifamily Millionaire Podcast. I'll make sure to have that link in the show notes, but I really wanted to call out your podcast and direct some new listeners over to your show, because I know that there's a lot of great information there as well. We're kind of running out of time here today, Jason, but one of the things that I've learned, especially when it comes to realtors and high performing real estate investors, there's typically processes and routines that they kind of stick to. Do you have anything in that regard? Are there like a routine that you stick to that you do every single day that has gotten to you where you are today?
Yeah, I think the number one thing is I spend a minimum of 4 hours a day prospecting for new business. So from 9 to noon and from at least 5 to 6, 5 to 7, I'll be, in the office prospecting for new business, whether it's texting, emailing, calling new property owners to see if they're looking to buy or sell or looking to make a move. So I think spending those hours every single day to look for new potential clients has been the number one thing that's kind of number one routine that's made my business kind of slowly move up. Yeah.
I really need to call that out. You said you do 4 hours a day. I mean, a lot of people, especially when it comes to real estate investor, it's one of those real estate investing myths that I keep trying to bust, is the concept that this is an easy process. And a lot of people don't see behind the scenes to know that to find that one opportunity or find that one investment, you're taking 4 hours a day to mine that information and look for, actively looking for the next thing.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely a slow and steady process, and you might go 1 to 2 weeks without finding a single good lead, but the week after that, you might get 5 good leads. So, some weeks are better than others, but if you just keep chipping away and keep, mining, keep looking for gold, you'll eventually find it. So, right. It's just the process that you have to follow every single day in order to make progress.
Well, if you don't mind, I have a few rapid fire questions for you just to learn a little bit more about you, Jason.
For sure.
Well, first of all, I already talked about one of my real estate investing myths I like to bust. What is one of yours?
One of the real estate myths I like to bust, I think, is you have to be a certain age to kind of get started in the business. I think a lot of people told me, and I have a lot of friends that told them that, you're too young to get into real estate. I think if you have the right mindset and you can get over that age gap, so whereas people say, I think it's a big myth. You can be whatever age you want starting real estate.
Great. With that, what book would you recommend everybody checking out? And you're not allowed to say Rich Dad, Poor Dad.
I haven't even read that book. I would say Never Split the Difference by Chris Voss. It's an amazing, phenomenal book about negotiation and how to deal with people. And when you're in the real estate business, you're in the people business, not the real estate business. It goes people, then real estate. So I would say definitely check out that book if you're looking to get into real estate.
Yeah, I can't echo that one enough. In fact, there's only a handful of books that I also not only listen to the audiobook, I have the Kindle version and I have a hard copy. There's only a handful of books that I've gone to that extent. So, and that's one of them. What is the best piece of business advice you've ever received?
The best piece of business advice I've ever received, I think, would be that have a long-term mindset. I think we live in a world of instant gratification. I think delayed gratification is the key to succeeding in business, especially in real estate, because it takes a long time before all your hard work pays off. So, like I said, even if you have a month of no business and it seems like you're just calling for no reason and making no money, just know that you're working and chipping away towards something big. So I'd say having that delayed gratification, where we live in a world of instant gratification, is extremely important.
Okay, great. What is one of your biggest business mistakes you've made and how did you recover from it?
Biggest business mistake by far is hiring an unlicensed contractor. It was actually a referral for my client, so I really trusted in the contractor, but he didn't have his license. He had the worst accounting, put nothing in writing. It was got a handshake agreement, and it was the second property I ever bought, and it was a 4-unit. 3 months goes by. He says he's doing work. I'm checking on the project. He's doing the minimum to make it seem like he's doing something. He ends up pestering me for $80,000 and did about probably 10 or 15 grand worth of work, saying he had to pay his guys early. I didn't know anything about the contractor world, so I thought I was doing the right thing by paying him early, which is something you should never, ever do. Only pay someone after the job is done. And the guy went rogue on me. He went away, never heard from him again, called him, texted him a million times, don't know where he lives. And yeah, it's just a bad situation. So that's the worst mistake I ever made.
Okay. Wow. Once bitten, twice shy, I'm sure. Have you found that experience has soured you on other contractors, or have you been able to get your mindset to back to where it needs to be?
It didn't sour me. It just made me extremely cautious and made me learn extremely fast. I think I definitely went through the school of hard knocks on that one as hard as you could get. And I think getting hit in the face like that and taking that big of a loss just makes you extremely cautious on who to pick, how on top of people you have to be. And the knowledge of construction that I have now is unmatched from back then. So,
right. If you could go back into time and give your younger self one piece of advice, what would that be?
I would say to him, don't be so scared of the world. Don't be scared of people that are higher status than you. You know, they're just people. The world is shaped by people that, you know, are much smarter than you. So you can do whatever you want. I would say that, I would say that a lot of my younger life, I lived scared and in fear. Once I finally stepped out of that mindset, the whole world changed for me. So I think if anyone listening to the show is in that state of mind, I would just say, that's my advice for you, is just try to break out of that fear state.
Well, with one last question I have is there a question or concept you wished we would have covered here today?
No, I really appreciate you having me on. You're a fantastic podcast host. Would love to have you on mine as well. I guess the only thing I would say is if you want to get more free content or learn more about me, you could also check out my Instagram, which is Jason Joseph Lee. I post a lot of content on there for nothing in return. So, if you want to keep up and stay in touch on the socials, let me know. I'll follow you back as well.
Well, I appreciate that. I'll also make sure to have that link in the show notes, but Jason, really appreciate your time today. And, I hope you'll come back again sometime. This was a great conversation.
Yeah, thank you. I agree.
If you learned at least one actionable step to incorporate into your real estate investing, if so, please consider returning some of that value by leaving a positive review, subscribing to our YouTube channel, or joining our growing network on Facebook and Twitter. You can find links to all of our social media accounts in the show notes. See you next time.